The ninth lecture of the machine learning course. So today's lecture will be more about a follow-up of the previous lecture on doing dimensionality reduction. So in the previous lecture, we learned about a linear technique for doing dimensionality reduction, which is called principal components analysis, or PCA, where the goal was to build some covariance matrix and to diagonalize it and to pick the components. For instance, if you were to do dimensionality reduction on a plane, we could pick the most important components, which is called the first principal components, which corresponds to the largest eigenvalue of the covariance matrix. And then we could also pick the second largest eigenvalue, which corresponds to what's called the second principal component. So in that sense, we hope that if this works, we would get something like two clusters or more clusters of different data points that belong to potentially different labels that we don't know about in advance. Okay, so this is a linear method. In this lecture, we will learn about a nonlinear method called TSNE, which stands for T-distributed stochastic neighbor embedding. So we'll learn about what this stands for during the lecture. And if we have time, I'm going to talk about generative modeling. I'm going to talk about some introduction to generative modeling before diving deeper into that in the next lecture. But before going into that, I just wanted to highlight one comment that was highlighted by one of your classmates regarding the data normalization in PCA. So that's something that was important to highlight regarding the normalization of the different variables in a certain data point. So if for spins, we didn't have that issue because spins have plus and minus one, so they have, all the spins have almost the same range. So if we take the absolute value of all spins, that's just one, so you have all the same magnitude. But if you're dealing with different parameters where one variable has the order of 10 to the 5 and the other variable is 10 to the 1, then we will have the artifact that one axis will have a large variance just because that they have a large scale. So we need to account for that. So in this case, if the variables don't have a similar range, we need to do rescaling before running PCA. Okay? But in our application, we don't have to deal with that, just in case you have encountered this kind of issue in another application. Okay? So let's get started and see how TSNE works. So TSNE relies on a measure of similarity between different data points. So so it relies on the following. So given two data points, xi and xj, we define a similarity, which looks like a probability of j given the data point I. By the way, is this visible for you? Okay. So it's defined as the following. So we, on the numerator of that probability, we define an exponential factor that's weighted by the Euclidean distance between the two data points. Divided by this variance, or this variance sigma I squared, which I'm going to talk about in a second, and we divide by the normalization, which corresponds to the sum over all data points in our data set that are different from our data point I of the same factor. So what this means is that if I have a data point j that's the closest to I, then this factor will be the largest. And if I have a data point that's the furthest away from my data point I, then this will be the lowest, okay? So the further I am from a data point I, xi, the further I am, the lower this similarity probability measure will be, okay? So far, so good. And of course, if I have, if I want to compute the probability of I given I, that's for sure has to be zero. Okay, so that's by definition. Okay, and something that I didn't talk about here is this, is these parameters sigma i's. So the sigma i's are actually our hyperparameters. That are related to what's called the perplexity. So that's something that I want you to understand in the second homework. So that's something I would encourage you to read more about in the second homework. So there, I'll provide a link for you to see how that measure, which is perplexity, is related to those sigma i's and how that affects the results of TSNE, okay? But for the sake of today's lecture, you don't need to understand the details to be able to understand the principle. Okay, so that's a hyperparameter that you play with. Okay. Is there a question? Okay, so all I've done so far is just I defined this probability of j given I, which has this form, okay? And what I'm gonna do is define a symmetric form of this probability such that I'm not putting I to be something that's very special. So I wanted to put j and I to be symmetric. So one thing TSNE does is like they define the symmetric probability, which has the form of B, J given I, plus B, I given J over 2N, where N is the number of data points in our data set. So you might wonder where this comes from. You could actually see this from the fact that if I have a probability distribution like this, this is can be written as bi given j times bj, right? It can be also written as bj given I times bi. It can be written also as the average of the two, right? So I could also write it as 1 over 2 bi given j bj plus pj given I pi. And what you could see here is that what TSNE does is that it assumes that where all the data points are equally important, so pi is 1 over n, and 1 over pj is also 1 over n. And this will, you see that exactly gives you this symmetric form of the probability distribution of two data points, I and j. Yeah.
I can see why the probability of I given I is zero. Like, if the only place where j seems to appear is in the exponential, and if the power of zero is one.
Yeah, so the reason why we, like, this was set to zero is that you don't want, like, this to be non-zero, because, like, that would give, like, importance to, like, would give a higher, like, similarity measure to like a data points to itself. So we want a similarity measure between data points to the other data points, not the data points to itself.
So it's defined for j not equal to I and for j equal to I.
Yeah, so this is for j different to I here, and here only for the case when I, for the data points itself. Okay.
That was also my question.
Yeah.
So if we are very close to point I, we're
yeah.
going to get a high similarity measure, right?
Yeah.
If we get to I, then it's going to be zero. I don't see how. So what are we? Is it going to become clearer when we
yeah.
start using it? Okay.
Yeah, so this will become clearer after we're going to use this definition. So far, I'm just doing the definition, okay? I'm not explaining t-SNE yet, so I'm just defining I'm just using like the definitions that they use to define the t-SNE algorithm, okay? Okay, so now, as is the goal of dimensionality reduction, we want to have a data point xi from something that has size n to a lower size to a projection that has a lower size n prime. So we want to. So that's a similar goal to PCA. Want to find a lower dimensional representation x prime that belongs to a lower dimensional space in such a way that we preserve the similarity distribution P I and J, okay? So what I mean by that is that we want to find another distribution Q I J that is as close as possible to P ij, where Q now takes data points that lives in this lower dimensional space, okay? So Q will have a form that looks like this, f of the distance between xi prime minus xj prime over the sum of k different from I of f of x I prime minus x k prime. Okay, so it's the same as the same form as the function as b, but we want now to use a different function than compared to the exponential. Okay. So this function f is not is something I have not defined yet, and I'm going to tell you in a second what this function looks like, okay? So that's for I different from j. Okay. Sorry, I should have specified that this is q given Q given J, or QJ given I, in that the symmetric form is defined in a similar way compared to B, I, and J. Okay? So I defined Qj given I in a similar form to a similar way to P, and at the end I'm going to define the symmetric form of Q, which lives in a lower dimensional space in a similar way to P. Okay, is this clear so far for everyone? Okay. Yeah.
Maybe it's better if we, in the formula for the pij, maybe for the denominator, it's better we use m instead of n, because it seems we already use m as the for number of data points.
Oh, so you mean I?
No, no, the pij.
Oh, for n. Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you mean we should m?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
What a confusion.
That's a good point. Yeah, let's do that. Thank you. Okay. So now what I haven't told you yet is how we could choose this function f, and how can we make this probability distribution q as close as possible to p, so that we can make our dimensionality reduction from this higher dimensional space to a lower dimensional space. Okay, so this is the 2 points I'm going to answer. But the first question I'm going to answer is, how can we get that function f that is suitable enough so that we can model this probability distribution q? So that actually relies on this intuition, which consists of going from one to two dimensions to one dimension. So if I have three data points, x1, x2, or x0, x1, and x2, like the following, and assuming I have a distance 1 between x0 and x1, and a distance 1 as well between x1 and x2. So this means that because I have a right angle here, this distance should be 2, okay? So DSNE like focuses on, the main focus of DSNE is to prioritize shortened distances compared to larger distances. What this means is that if I want to go to a lower dimensional representation, then I should have x1 in the middle here, and I should have x2 here and x0 here, and I should have distance 1 here and distance 1 here. Okay, and as a consequence, this distance should be 2, okay? So by going from a two-dimensional representation to a one-dimensional representation, this distance got increased to 2, but these shortened distances are preserved, okay? So what this means is that the range actually increased when we went from a lower dimensional, from a larger, for dimension 2 to dimension 1, okay? And this is what would be the principle of DSNE. It would be actually to consider a distribution that's actually fatter compared to the Gaussian distribution, which is actually decreases like very quickly. Okay, so this is what we're going to consider. See, if I were to plot the distribution q as a function of xj prime and xi prime, so if I were to consider the data points in the original space in two dimensions, in particular the distance between x0 and x2, then the similarity measure, let's assume that it will be somewhere over here. And if we use the Gaussian, so that will be P or Q. So let me use red for P. So it will start somewhere higher and going down like this. So that's for the Gaussian distribution. And if we're now considering the distance between x prime 0 and x prime 2, then the distance will be 2. So in that sense, it will be somewhere over here. In this case, the similarity between x0 prime and x2 prime is actually lower, or So similarity. Between x0 prime and x2 prime is lower compared to p x0 and x2 in the original space. Okay, so that's the original similarity given by Q of 0, 2, or of B of 0, 2, but that would be the value of Q 0, 2 if we use the same exponential function, right? So what we want is to consider a function that decays slow in a slower, like that's decays like in a fashion such that we want the similarity measure between x0 prime and x2 prime to be the same as the similarity measure in the original space. Okay, so you want to consider a function f such that we have something like this. So that's q here. So we want here to have the same similarity in the lower dimensional space. Okay. And it turns out that a good choice for F is the so-called T-student distribution that does exactly this, that. So if we choose f of z equal to 1 over 1 plus z squared, so this is called the T-student distribution. So this distribution is actually a function that decays in a slower fashion compared to the exponential, which decays much faster, right? So you could also see the reason why we need to have a fatter, if you can say this term, a fatter distribution compared to the exponential. You could consider the example of this analogy of having, for instance, like 100 people living in a building, let's say that has 50 floors, okay. And you want to move these people to only one floor, would in such a way that the first floor has the same size as in this building. And so if you do that, for sure you'll observe that there'll be crowding, right? So in order to solve that crowding problem, we need to enlarge the size of that floor in such a way that there is less crowding, okay? So we need to consider a much larger floor so that there is less crowding between different people. And what I meant, and actually this crowding is actually what is observed over here when we have a lower similarity measure between data points in a new projection. So in order to have the same similarity measure in the lower dimensional space, we need to kind of enlarge our space in the lower dimensional representation, which is similar to the analogy I've considered over there. Okay, so is this clear for everyone? Yeah.
When you originally drew that diagram, you put those three points so that they formed a rectangle, but is that a requirement, or could they be in any position? Because if they're in any position, they could all be on a line. And if they were on a line, there'd be no degradation in terms of the dimensionality of any of the edges.
Yeah, for sure. So if we were to consider them on a line, that means that this is not—it's not necessary to do this projection. But here, I've taken an example where they're not linear, like collinear. So in that case, that makes sense because we will have like—is that what you were asking about?
Yeah, I'm just thinking that if you've got a lot of data points, some of them will be on a line and they won't have any degradation in terms of distance, and others won't be on a line and will.
For sure. Yeah. So that's as the case you mentioned is a fine-tuned case. So in real-world examples, happens like in a rare care scenario. So in the general case, we will have data points that are not collinear to each other in general. Yeah. But as you mentioned, like if we already have a one-dimensional data set, then we could just use that line where the data points are aligned so that we can do the projection. Yeah.
Some of the data might be one-dimensional and some.
Right. No, that's a great point. Yeah. Okay, so that answers that question regarding the choice of this function f. Now, what I didn't answer yet is how can we choose the positions of x prime, the x prime I, like the data points x prime i's where I go from the number 1 to m, where m is the total number of data points, in such a way that q ij is as close as possible to pij, okay? So how can we optimize the positions so that we have the same similarity measure? Okay, so that's something I will try to answer very briefly. So to find a lower dimensional representation, well, of our data set D prime, which consists of data points X primes. So what we need to do is to update, to consider those parameters, to those data points as actually some trainable parameters. So what we do is we iteratively update the points x primes using gradient descent . If we say gradient descent, then we need a cost function. And it turns out that a good choice of that cost function is the so-called KL divergence, or Kullback-Leibler divergence, that I'm going to define in a second. So it's defined this way. It's called DKL, and it's denoted this way. And it's defined as the sum over all the indices J and I, which goes from 1 to the total number of data points. And it's defined as bij log of bij over qij. Okay, so that's called the Kullback-Leibler or KL divergence. And you might be wondering why that's a good measure for a cost function. Well, it turns out that if you compute that quantity for any two probability distributions, you'll find out that this is always positive. Okay, so what this means that it's lower bounded by zero. So that's the first note. And you could show this using Jensen's inequality. I would love to show you this here, but just for the interest of time, maybe I'll leave this as an exercise for you. Okay. So just in case you have any question, let me know. I could answer that after the lecture. But this is like the first important thing about the KL divergence. The other interesting measure, the interesting property is that if you have this equal to zero, then this means, and it's actually an equivalence, this means that Pij is equal to Qij for all I and j, okay? For all possible combinations of the data points, then the two properties P and Q are actually the same. So what this means is that if we optimize this cost function until we reach out something that's very close to zero, this means that I actually managed to make my new similarity measure close to the Gaussian similarity measure in the original space. So at this point, I will find that I have a good representation of data points x I primes, of x primes that are that have a same similarity measure as the ones that I have in the original space. Okay. So far, so good. Yeah.
Don't you need to say that I is not equal to j, so you also avoid all the zeros? You'll have log of zero, but you'll also have a upfront multiple.
Yeah. So if I have I equal to j, then this is by definition equal to zero, and I also have here that equal to zero, so I won't have an issue. I can take the limiting case where
you're taking zero times infinity.
Well, yeah, I can. So I can always like take that equal to zero. Okay. So, but for sure, if I want to avoid that, I could also take the case when they are not. I could also avoid that case. But just in case, like you've not seen before, that's also possible to include. Okay. So just to summarize, what we do is we define this probability in this lower dimensional space using this T student distribution in such a way that I consider a fatter distribution. And at the end, what I do is I consider these data points x primes as trainable parameters that I update using my cost function until I get convergence, where I hope that I will get some separation between my clusters my data points that don't have labels. Okay. Yeah.
Do you assume that QII is equal to zero, or do you have to discover that? You've got the PII is equal to zero, and we're trying to fit.
No, I guess yeah. In that case, like even if it's non-zero, that will be multiplied by zero over here.
I'm just asking, when you do your learning, do you start with the assumption that QII is equal to zero?
Yeah, I guess so.
The assumption that PII is equal to zero, and you want
So that's a very good point. So what we want at the end is that the similarity measure to be the same between data points that are different, not the same data points. Yeah, no, but that's a very good point. Yeah, it's good to exclude that case to avoid confusion for sure. Okay, so before now going to generative modeling, I just wanted to show you a demo about how T-SNE works, just so that you can connect with what we've seen here. So this is an illustration of the T of the MNIST data set, which consists of handwritten digits from 1 to 10. So here, this initial representation corresponds to like an initial guess for these lower dimensional representation of X primes. So initially in the TSNE algorithm, what we do is we randomly initialize these X primes. So here you see that they look random, right? So what I can do is do a gradient descent and optimize until I hopefully converge to something that's mimics the similarity in the original space. So if I do this, so if I run the optimization, at some point you see that the clusters are forming. And this means that, well, I have a, it looks beautiful. So you could see that the clusters are forming after I do the optimization, okay? Mm-hmm. And one interesting thing I could also highlight is that if I reset, and if I do the optimization again, you'll get a completely different clustering. So maybe you could tell me why you think that's the case. Why if I start from a different run, I get a different result, yeah.
You mentioned that it's stochastic, so it is random.
Exactly, yeah. So that's because of the stochasticity of this algorithm. So that's something that's different from PCA. In PCA, you have a deterministic algorithm. You have a deterministic covariance matrix that you diagonalize. Mm-hmm. But for TSNE, the results you'll get will be different from each time you run it. And that's something you'll see in the second homework assignment, okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where is the stochasticity exactly?
Yeah, so that comes from the fact when you randomly initialize the data points. So for instance, here you see the initial definition of X primes in this algorithm is completely random. So the random point you choose is actually what determines the last point where you will land. Okay. So if I, for instance, observe these like black numbers over here, so they are over on the left, and if I do it again, you'll see that they landed somewhere in the middle now, okay? So just something to note here, and that you'll have a chance to see this again in the second homework, which is, by the way, already posted in the portal today, okay? And before I go into generative modeling, do you have any questions about TSNE? Yeah.
Is this showing us in two dimensions the distances as they were roughly in the n dimensions?
Well,
what is this picture actually showing?
So this is like a three-dimensional, yeah, it's actually a projection of the two-dimensional. So actually, like if you were to see this like in a video, like you'll see a rotation in 3D space. But of course, this is like, as you said, like this is an n-dimensional, originally it was an n-dimensional picture. So what this means is that, the distances, like the similarity between like two like different numbers, is actually preserved in this lower dimensional representation. So this is why you see different clusters forming. So you see that numbers that look the same close to each other, and numbers that are different are far from each other. And this is what's translated back in TSNE by this idea of preserving the similarity. So this is the guiding principle in this algorithm. Yeah, they're not necessarily the same because you've saw in that example, square root of 2 went to 2, but it's actually the similarity in the sense that closer data points are still closer in the lower dimensional representation and far data points that are further from each other are still further from each other in the lower dimensional representation, okay? Okay. Do you have any other questions? I'm trying to like be as slow as possible on this part, just to make sure you understood the principle.
Just to clarify,
yeah.
If the points are a long way apart, that means the original distance is also a long way apart.
Exactly, yeah. So for instance, you see here, so in the red cluster, I guess you'll see the fives, which will look completely different from the twos. So do you see here they're further away from each other, okay? And that holds also the same for Ising configurations. The paramagnetic configurations will look far, like, well, the distance between ferromagnetic configurations and ferromagnetic configurations will be actually larger compared to configurations that belong to the same phase. For instance, configurations that are both ferromagnetic or configurations that are both paramagnetic. Okay? Okay, so now, yeah, let's move on to generative modeling for the rest of time that we have for the lecture. So that's another application of unsupervised learning beyond dimensionality reduction. So what we want is that given data points x1, x2, until xm, coming from some distribution p data of x, and the setup here is that we usually don't know what's the p data is because it's a higher dimensional probability. So for instance, assume that you're given pictures of cats, but you don't know what's the probability that gives the pictures of cats in the real world. So what we want is, the goal here is to find parameters lambda of a model for a certain probability p lambda of x, such that our model is as close as possible to the data points that we don't know, just by having a knowledge of the data, not by having knowledge of the underlying probability distribution. Okay. So one thing we could do this is by, as I've said earlier, one could cost function that allow us to minimize some sort of a distance between the two probabilities by choosing the KL divergence. So one could minimize the KL divergence between the two probability distributions. And this is given in the same definition as in the other blackboard, so that's the sum over all data points x of p data x log of p data x over p lambda x. Okay, so it's the same definition as we choose over there. And before like developing this expression, I just wanted to explain why generative modeling is very good. It's something that's important to do. So imagine in this previous example that I've highlighted regarding the pictures of cats. So imagine you want to generate new pictures of cats. Having a good model for p lambda such that it's as close as possible to the p data would allow us to generate new pictures. And you could also imagine doing the same for phases of matter. So you want to learn the probability of configurations in a certain phase of matter, and you want to generate new configurations that look the same, it's good to do this generative modeling task so that you can generate new configurations that are different from the ones that we have in the training data. Okay? So far, so good? Yeah.
Do we have access to P data?
No, so that's something we don't know, so it's unknown. Okay? In practice, that would need an exponential complexity to know the total number, to, like, you know that, for instance, for spins, the total number of possibilities is 2 to 3 n. So enumerating all of these and storing the memory is practice very impractical. Yeah. Okay. Other applications will be, for instance, to fill in gaps in data. In some applications, you have a like low amount of data points. And if you're able to model the P data without having necessarily access to it, you could generate new data points so that you could fill in the gaps in the data. For instance, you could sample new data. You could also do a lot of amazing things that I'm going to show you later on tomorrow, where you could generate new pictures. You could also do quantum state tomography just out of samples that you could get from a quantum computer. So there's a lot of impressive applications of this type of unsupervised learning task, okay? So now let's see how can we use that, minimize that KL divergence, starting from these data points, okay? So prior you see here that we have a sum over an exponential number of terms, because for instance, if we're dealing with discrete data points, spins, we will have an exponential number of terms over here, okay? So we need, clearly need a different, to choose a different path to estimate the KL divergence or to minimize the KL divergence. So one thing I could do is I could separate the KL divergence into two parts. So we'll have the first term would look like something like the following: p data of x log of p data of x, right? And then I will have minus this term times the log of this term. So now, as you can see over here, I don't have any dependence on the parameters lambda over here, okay? So this looks like an entropy term, right? So you could consider that as the negative entropy of the data, and it's constant with respect to the parameters lambda. So if I were to optimize the KL divergence so that I could minimize it, then I don't need to consider that term over here. I would just need to minimize that term over here. And interestingly, what's good about this term is that I have a probability times the log of an upper probability. In this case, I only need to consider the configurations that appear more often, or that have the highest weights compared to those that have the lowest weights. And actually the data that we get from the p data are actually the ones that appear more often, or that looks like that they have the highest probabilities. So in this sense, we could approximate this sum. So we could approximate this whole thing as the average the log of minus log of p lambda xi, where I goes from 1 to n, okay? So that's an average, and it's an approximate way to estimate this quantity, which looks like it's intractable, but we could use the data points that we got from our p data as a way to approximate this quantity that we have over here. And you could see that this is something that's looks like So this motivates the naming of the negative log likelihood okay, so here it's an average over all data points. And basically what this says is that if I want to minimize the KL divergence, then I will need to minimize the negative log likelihood. Okay, so the arg, the optimal parameters correspond to the arg min of P data, the KL divergence of P data and P lambda, which is the same as the argmin of the negative log likelihood. Right? And since we have a minus sign over here, it will be the same as maximizing the log likelihood, right? And since here I have a sum of logs, then it's the same as the log of the product, right? So let me write this slowly. So it'll be the argmax of. So since I have a constant term here, I can also drop it. This will be the log of the product and maximizing the log of the of this term is the same as maximizing the product itself, okay? And it turns out that the products of the probabilities given by the model for each data point is what we call the likelihood. And this actually motivates why we call this term here the negative log likelihood. Okay? Mm-hmm. And in the same time, this also motivates why we call the reason behind what's called the maximum likelihood principle. Okay, so the maximum likelihood principle consists of maximizing the likelihood of the data points in our model. So what we want is to get the parameters, which we can call lambda MLE, that correspond to the argmax, or to the parameters that maximize the likelihood function. Okay, so what this means is that we want the parameters lambda that maximize the probabilities of all the data points. Another way of saying this is that we want the parameters such that our data points makes more sense for the model, like would have the highest probabilities in the model. And it turns out that this principle, maximum likelihood principle, according to this derivation, is the same as minimizing the KL divergence. Okay? So whenever you see the maximum likelihood principle, it turns out it's actually the same as the common goal is actually to find a model such that our model distribution is the same as the p data distribution, although we don't have ORT access to the p data. Okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The selection of the number of terms, the m terms, is essentially a hyperparameter, right?
So yeah. So m is a hyperparameter. Like if you're given a chance to tune the number of data points, but in the real world, like the number of data points is actually something that's given to you. So if you're running a quantum computer and you're sampling, like you're doing measurements, the number of configurations that you'll get will be determined by the cost of of like sampling. So typically that's something that's fixed in for instance, in a real like world data set in the field of medicine, the number of like MRI scans that you will get is something that's fixed. So that's something that's fixed by your data. And out of that, you have to work out a model, P lambda, such that you're as close as possible to P data so that you can sample new configurations out of that. And maybe like a follow-up to your question, like why we don't maximize the likelihood right away, the reason is that like each probability is something that's expected to be lower than one. So multiplying like many numbers that are less than one are expected to produce a very low number. So that's something that's very hard to optimize. And it turns out that the thing we get from the KL divergence, which is the negative log likelihood, is something that's easier to optimize because the log of something that's very small is going to give you a number that's have a reasonable amplitude that you can actually optimize easily compared to the maximum likelihood that principle that we have over here. Okay? Yeah.
Can I think of this as just an application of learning? Because I think of these probabilities as my labels and my points. It's basically that, and this Cooper-Library divergence is just a cost function.
Exactly, yeah. So that's, yeah, absolutely. You could also make a link with supervised learning, where you're actually like you could also actually derive the mean squared error loss from this. Like if you wanted, we could talk about this after. Just I didn't have time to cover this, but this is a very important observation. You could always, using this maximum likelihood principle in the KL divergence, you could make a link between unsupervised learning and supervised learning. Okay, yeah, very good observation. And last thing I want to highlight as well before just showing an example of this on a Gaussian. On a Gaussian model. So if I, like, one thing I want to highlight is that we should have these data points xi to be independent from each other so that you can consider the product of individual probabilities as the joint probability of all the data points. Okay? Which is something that's this is something we typically have in a data set. We assume that the data points we have are independent from each other. For instance, if we have the measurements from a quantum computer, typically what we do is we rerun the quantum computer so that we can get a new data point, okay? Yeah, I think this is mostly what I wanted to cover. At the end, I just wanted to show you an illustration for how this works for a Gaussian distribution. So what I wanted to show you here is a bunch of data points in one dimension. So I'm gonna sample like 100 data points from a Gaussian distribution with a certain mean in a certain standard deviation. So this is what I'm doing over here. So I'm assuming that I already know what's the p data, okay? But of course, in real world applications, we don't know. So I'm assuming that the mean of that Gaussian distribution is 1, and the sigma of that Gaussian distribution is 1. And I'm going to sample 100 data points out of this Gaussian distribution. And those will be my data points x1, x2, until xm. Okay. And initially, I'm going to make a guess. So I'm going to make a model, which is also Gaussian. Of course, this is something we don't know in reality. Like here, I kind of cheated, but I just wanted to show you proof of principle. my model will be actually a Gaussian again, which has a mean initially equal to 0.5 in a standard deviation of 0.1, which are different from the ones that we are expecting. Okay, so I'm going to start from something that looks far away. And if I were to plot my model, my initial guess, compared to the true distribution, you'll see that we're actually far away. So the blue one is my initial guess, and the red one corresponds to the true distribution. I want to, using this likelihood, maximum likelihood principle, I want to shift the parameters so that I'm as close as possible to the true distribution, which is our goal throughout this generative modeling. So I want to do this only using data. And one way of doing this is by minimizing the negative log likelihood, which is, again, the same as minimizing the KL divergence. Okay, so there's a package in SciPy that allows us to do this. You can just assume that we can compute the negative log likelihood over here. And at the end, I'm going to get the estimates for the mu and sigma after the optimization. And if I plug in those in my model, you see here that I have something that looks very, very close to my original distribution, okay? So of course, I cheated here because I assume that I know what's the form of the model. I assume that I have a Gaussian model. But you could imagine that in like more complicated situations, if we run this optimization, we could hopefully achieve something that looks something like that so that we can generate new data points from our model. Yeah.
But then you also have a lot of freedom in P lambda, right? In what P lambda is? Like,
yeah. So P lambda in that case is just a Gaussian.
Right.
But in real world applications, that could be a neural network or any model that you want. You could throw in all the machinery we learned today to have a model for this P lambda. Okay. It doesn't have to be a neural network, but for the sake of this course, typically what people use is neural networks with all different sorts that I'm going to explain in the next lecture tomorrow. Okay, so tomorrow will be a brief overview about all the different models for this P lambda that I've talked to you about today. Okay, so I hope this lecture was informative. Like, let me know if you have any questions. Thank you.